Very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Adema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. We are almost out of time, but before we go, let's look at some news and trends in the country's agricultural industry. Here we go now. Drought is a serious issue affecting global food security as the world tries to grapple with the effects of climate change and overall global warming. Iran is also dealing with low rainfall as some of its provinces are sounding drought alarms. This is bad.
Lorestan province is one that's heavily impacted by declining seasonal rainfall. Officials say its agricultural sector has witnessed over $360 million in damages, with livestock and aquaculture suffering the most considerable losses. In addition, Iran's Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture recently released a report on the falling precipitation levels. The report lists several provinces in a critical state of water shortage, including Fars, Khorasan-Razavi and Ardabil, among others. Official estimates revealed the agriculture sector was inflicted with $2.4 billion in losses due to water shortages last year.
Venezuela is looking for ways to cooperate with Iran to strengthen the Latin American country's agriculture sector. Let's have a look.
During a visit to Iran, Venezuela's agriculture and land minister said his country is interested in transferring advanced know-how and technology from Iran. Wilmer Castro Soltelo says these mainly lay in Iran's fields of fertilizer production, biological pesticides, livestock probiotics, and aquatic animals. Soteldo added that his ministry intends to boost cooperation with Iranian knowledge-based companies to bring change to Venezuela's agriculture sector. Venezuela is a top producer of corn, coffee, cotton, and rice, among other things.
In terms of value, pistachios still wear the crown at the top of Iran's export list. And last year, around 140,000 tons of these nuts were sent off to foreign markets. Very popular they are indeed.
Nearly $1 billion worth of pistachios were purchased by 75 countries from Iran. Fresh and unprocessed pistachios were the most sought after, raking in $700 million. China, Russia, India, and the UAE were the top destinations for this agricultural product. Iran's Customs Administration, however, says exports declined last year compared to the year 2020. The administration said drought and damage to domestic pistachio productions last year caused a 30% drop in both weight and value of these exports.
Let's hope something can be done about this drought business. Anyway, that wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As 2,500 West Bank residents face expulsion by the Zionist regime. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Shata Hamad, journalist. This article is published under the heading "The Palestinian Mothers of Masafer Yatta and the Fear of Displacement." Stay tuned for more. In the small kitchen of her home, threatened with demolition at any moment, Leila Mons was cooking rice and lamb-stuffed zucchini in yogurt sauce, the smell of the traditional Palestinian dish filling the place. Meanwhile, her children gathered in the living area preparing to eat lunch. As Mons stirred the yogurt on the stove, all that was racing through her mind was the fate of her and her family, for the Israeli regime has started to implement its decision to demolish 12 Palestinian villages in Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, where some 2,500 residents live, in order to turn the area into a military training zone. The Israeli regime army had previously demolished part of her family home in the village of Jamba, but the expulsions faced by Masafer Yatta today are not aimed at demolishing one house here or there, but rather to uproot all the residents of the area. Women will be among the worst affected by the mass expulsions. Firstly, they are already a marginalized group lacking basic needs in the community, such as women-only clinics and training centers. Secondly, they bear responsibility for their families, a task that is increasingly difficult and complicated under the harsh conditions in Masafer Yatta, and especially in Jamba, where the Israeli regime occupation prevents the building of infrastructure or the paving of streets. As a result, residents are kept living in primitive conditions. Mons, 44, shared with Middle East Eye the details of her daily life as a mother and as a woman. She said, "As women, our life here is hard. We start our days very early by milking the sheep, then make bread on the fire. After that, we make breakfast for the children before they head to school, and during the day, there are many duties we have to carry out." Mons has 12 children, four of whom have finished or are completing their university studies. Yunus studied vet medicine, Halima speech and audiology, Batul studies education, Rayan studies Arabic. "The main goal of educating our children is to reinforce our presence here and develop our village, Jamba. It's not easy, but we are working on achieving it," she said. These mothers' concerns over their children start from the very first moments of their life.
Mons, who constantly worries about her children, gave birth to her first child, Yunus, while being transported by tractor. Yunus survived miraculously, and I experienced the same suffering with each birth due to the difficulty of reaching the hospital and the presence of Israeli barriers that obstruct our movement, she said. These days, an additional concern preoccupies Mons Jamba School. Like the village's housing is threatened with demolition, a threat that hangs over all schools in Masafer Yatta, even though they were established with the support and funding of the European Union, Mons said. I'm worried about the fate of the children and their future. Where will they study if the schools are destroyed, and how will they achieve their dreams? This great fear of displacement hanging over the people of Masafer Yatta only intensifies the feelings of anxiety and tension for the women of Jamba. Mon said, I live with great anxiety. I feel that my throat is dry from the intensity of the fear we live in. We wait for the end of each day in order to feel that it has passed without us being displaced, and we prepare for a new day. All the women in Jamba feel this insecurity acutely. Two sisters, Fatima Ann Al-Jabarin, 58, and Halima Al-Jabarin, 52, talked to MEE as they prepared lunch for when their children returned from herding sheep. We mainly depend on grazing sheep. But the Israeli settlements and the army have come to surround us and prevent us from grazing freely, said Halima, adding, our children are constantly attacked by settlers and the army, which keeps us worried about them until they return. Fatima said that persecution by Israeli regime army extended into Jamba and into the homes of the residents. The settlers launch attacks on Jamba, and the army constantly breaks into our homes and conducts military exercises between them, which puts residents in danger all the time, Fatima told MEE. Even at night, the women of Jamba live in a state of anxiety due to danger from quite a different direction. One recent night, Halima and Fatima, who live in adjacent houses, saw a rattlesnake nearby, considered one of the most venomous snakes in Palestine. Fatima said, I used to hear it whenever it moved. I could not sleep for fear it might bite one of my children. I stayed up late and checked on them all the time. Halima said that after the birth of her daughter, her only child, she would rarely leave her, and that she was constantly worried about the snakes and scorpions. Halima said, one time I found a dead scorpion near my daughter, I panicked. What if it had stung her? She is my only child, and I am terrified of losing her. Fatima and Halima's preoccupations with their children's safety have led to them neglect their own health problems that have arisen as a result of their difficult living conditions. Both mothers suffer from breathing problems due to the dusty weather in Masafer Yatta, and Halima suffers from diabetes and high blood pressure. Halima said, women here may die before reaching the hospital. I sometimes suffer from high fluid levels in the lungs, and my life becomes in great danger. In June, Halima and Fatima lost their mother, Latifa Mahmoud Al-Jabarin, who was 95 years old. She died at the public hospital in Yatta, and neither Halima nor Fatima were able to be with her in her last moments. With the pain of their loss still all too present, they nevertheless must confront the continuing fragility of their own and their family's existence. There is real threat of our homes being demolished and of our displacement from Jamba and Masafer Yatta forever, said Halima, adding, we will not accept that, and we will never leave our homes even if they demolish them on top of our heads. Her mother was one of the most prominent members of Jamba. She was the only midwife who helped the women there give birth, rescued them when necessary, and saved their children. With her death, Jamba lost one of its most important women. Fatima cried as she talked about her late mother. We learned steadfastness from our mother, who was one of the most powerful women and on whom the village depended greatly. Today, it is not just us who lost a mother, it is the whole village. Since her death, the women of Jamba have had to move to the homes of their families and friends in Yata when their due date approached, so that they can be near to a hospital to save their lives and the lives of their offspring. They return a few days later with their children.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories, and this process is continuing, consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbas. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion U.S. dollars, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. empire's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014. And in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response. The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions, which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc's strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
U.S. President Joe Biden just visited the West Asia to promote Washington's agenda in that region. Apart from encouraging Washington's Arab allies to pump more oil into the market to bring down rising energy prices, Biden, on behalf of the Israeli regime, was trying to form a coalition against Iran. But the much-publicized event failed to garner support from the United States' Arab allies. Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the latest plot in the West Asia region failed because the regional countries do not trust Washington. Kanani also said Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security.
The Saudis are recognizing the U.S. is in decline, and Joe Biden is the symbol of America's decline, mentally, politically, socially, religiously. And they have embarked on a different geopolitical, economic, military agenda, and that is to unite with the BRICS nations and seek their political destiny elsewhere than within the United States. So I think Joe Biden's trip was an absolute failure. It didn't accomplish anything, and we knew it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Just the day before the summit between Biden and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries, plus Egypt, Jordan and Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said Baghdad will not be part of any camp or military alliance. He also said, quote, Iraq will not be a base for threatening any neighboring countries. The UAE, which is a close ally of both Saudi Arabia and the US, also dismissed the idea of forming an anti-Iran NATO-like military alliance. We are open to cooperation, but not cooperation targeting any other country in the region, and I specifically mention Iran. Such comments show that Biden, who has practically followed the anti-Iran policies of his predecessor Donald Trump, failed to achieve his stated objective of forming a military alliance against Tehran.
So this entire trip of Joe Biden's was a futile effort, wasted effort, and I think it only depreciated America in the eyes of other nations. And for that reason, other nations are seeking political alliances elsewhere, in other global institutions, such as the BRICS nations, and the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and other things.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman also dismissed the recent Israeli threats against the Islamic Republic as psychological warfare. Nasser Kanani says the Tel Aviv regime has neither the courage nor the capability to confront Iran militarily. He also vowed that Tehran would give a decisive and destructive response to any Israeli aggression. Iran's response to any idiocy committed by the Zionist regime would be destructive.
Not only is the United States incapable of any military conflict, but Israel is also incapable of any military conflict. And Israel is incapacitated, yet they are putting on an aura of functionality, an aura of threats. But at the heart, Israel has no capacity to wage a conflict against Iran. This is all bluff, and this trip confirms it.
Kanani's comments come in response to threats made by Israeli Army Chief Aviv Kohavi. The Israeli general has said, quote, "It's Israel's moral obligation to prepare a military response against Iran's nuclear program." He also added that such preparations for such a strike are at the center of the military's program. Kohavi's warmongering rhetoric against the Islamic Republic comes despite Iran's insistence that it's not seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has issued a religious decree against weapons of mass destruction. And just recently, Kamal Kharazi, the head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, rejected allegations that Iran seeks nuclear weapons. He said Iran has the technical capability to go beyond the current 60% uranium enrichment level, but it will not go that path. It's an open secret that Israel is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the region and has hundreds of warheads. The regime's officials have constantly threatened Iran with strikes on its nuclear facilities. The regime is responsible for the murder of a number of Iran's nuclear scientists. It has also carried out sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities. And its latest threats against Iran are just meant to shore up its crumbling hegemonic position.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
Yeah, I mean, this is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia. And so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the U.S. and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-a-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognized there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the U.S. out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the U.S. has is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. God says that if you are grateful, He will certainly give you more. In another, he says, And if you are ungrateful, my chastisement is truly severe. So both of these results are based on divine tradition, and it can work either way. Well, there are two cases referred to in Chapter Al-Imran. It is strange that these two cases are both referred to in one chapter, and are related to one event. Of course, there are two cases, but the two cases are related to one another. Two kinds of traditions are referred to, the tradition of victory and the tradition of defeat. One is in verses 173 of chapter Al-Imran. Those to whom the people said, Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them. But this increased their faith, and they said, Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee. So they returned with favor from Allah. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 3, verses 173 and 174.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have probably heard this story. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada, had been martyred in this battle. The Prophet had been wounded. The Commander of the Faithful had been wounded. Many people had been martyred. Tired, worn out, and wounded, they returned to Medina. The Quraysh, the same enemy who had failed to do anything, had struck a blow. But they had not been able to defeat the Muslims. They gathered outside Medina, just a few kilometers away from Medina, and said, "We will attack tonight. They are tired and won't be able to do anything. We will finish them off." Their agents went into Medina and started frightening people. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them." The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 173. They came and asked the people, "Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that." They, the enemy, was intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." They said, "No, we aren't afraid of them. God is with us." The Prophet asked those who had been wounded in Uhud that day to gather, and they did. He told them to go confront the enemy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
The Limelight.
The EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place, says Ramzi Baroud, journalist, in an article published under the heading "The War Diplomat: How Borrell and the West Lost the Global Battle of Narratives." Stay tuned for the details of this article. In a blog entry reflecting on the G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Bali, Indonesia, on July 7th to 8th, the High Representative of the European Union, Joseph Borrell, seems to have accepted the painful truth that the West is losing what he termed the global battle of narratives. Borrell admitted, "The global battle of narratives is in full swing, and for now, we are not winning." Borrell's piece is a testimony to the very erroneous logic that led to the so-called battle of narratives being lost in the first place. Borrell starts by reassuring his readers that despite the fact that many countries in the global south refuse to join the West sanctions on Russia, everybody agrees, though in abstract terms, on the need for multilateralism and defending principles such as territorial sovereignty. The immediate impression that such a statement gives is the West is the global, vanguard of multilateralism and territorial sovereignty. The opposite is true. The U.S. Western military interventions in Iraq, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and many other regions around the world have largely taken place without international consent and without any regard for the sovereignty of nations. In the case of the NATO war on Libya, a massively destructive military campaign was initiated based on the intentional misinterpretation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, which called for the use of all means necessary to protect civilians. Borrell, like other Western diplomats, conveniently omits the West's repeated and ongoing interventions in the affairs of other nations, while painting the Russian-Ukraine crisis as the starkest example of blatant violations of international law. Would Borrell employ such a strong language to depict the numerous ongoing war crimes in parts of the world involving European countries or their allies? For example, France's despicable war record in Mali, or even more obvious, the 75-year-old Israeli regime occupation of Palestine? When addressing food and energy security, Borrell lamented that many in the G20 have bought into the propaganda and lies regarding the actual cause of the food crisis. Again, Borrell was selective with his logic. While naturally, a war between the two countries that contribute a large share of the world's basic food supplies will detrimentally impact food security, Borrell made no mention that the thousands of sanctions imposed by the West on Moscow have disrupted the supply chain of many critical products, raw material, and basic food items. When the West imposed those sanctions, it only thought of its national interest, erroneously centered around defeating Russia. Neither the people of Sri Lanka, Somalia, Lebanon, nor frankly Ukraine were relevant factors in the West's decision. Borrell, whose job as a diplomat suggests that he should be investing in diplomacy to resolve conflicts, has repeatedly called for widening the scope of war on Russia, insisting that the war can only be won on the battlefield. Such statements were made with Western interest in mind, despite the obvious devastating consequences that Borrell's battlefield would have on the rest of the world. Still, Borrell had the audacity to chastise G20 members for behaving in ways that seemed, to him, focused solely on their national interest. The hard truth is that national interests often outweigh general commitments to bigger ideals, he wrote. If defeating Russia is central to Borrell's and the EU's bigger ideals, why should the rest of the world, especially in the global south, embrace the West's self-serving priorities? Borrell also needs to be reminded that the West's global battle of narratives has been lost well before February 24th. Much of the global South rightly sees the West's interests at odds with its own. This seemingly cynical view is an outcome of decades. In fact, hundreds of years of real experiences, starting with colonialism and ending presently with the routine military and political interventions. Borrell speaks of bigger ideals as if the West is the only morally mature entity that is capable of thinking about rights and wrongs in a selfless, detached manner. In addition to there being no evidence to support Borrell's claim, such condensing language, itself an expression of cultural arrogance, makes it impossible for non-Western countries to accept or even engage with the West regarding the morality of its politics. Borrell, for example, accuses Russia of a deliberate attempt to use food as a weapon against the most vulnerable countries in the world, especially in Africa. Even if we accept this problematic premise as a morally driven position, how can Borrell justify the West sanctions that have effectively starved many people in vulnerable countries around the world? Perhaps Afghans are the most vulnerable people in the world today, thanks to the 20 years of a devastating US-NATO war, which has killed and maimed tens of thousands. Though the US and its Western allies were forced out of Afghanistan last August, billions of dollars of Afghan money are illegally frozen in Western bank accounts, pushing the whole country to the brink of starvation. Why can Borrell not apply his bigger ideals in this particular scenario, demanding immediate unfreezing of Afghan money? In truth, Borrell, the EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place. Winning or losing that battle never mattered to Western leaders in the past, because the Global South was hardly considered when the West made its unilateral decisions regarding war, military interventions, or economic sanctions. The Global South matters now, simply because the West is no longer determining all political outcomes, as was often the case. Russia, China, India, and others are now relevant because they can collectively balance out the skewed global order that has been dominated by Borrell and his likes for far too long.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awada and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League, the answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Miqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc.
From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual